Dear listeners, welcome to the Public Perception of Science podcast.
My name is Lieven Heremans.
And mine is Bram Harkema.
As you might know, the role of academic research in society is undergoing some serious discussions at the moment. For us as students, this discussion was actualized by last year's Maagdenhuis appropriation in Amsterdam. We feel the need to investigate and reflect academically upon the public perception of science and academia. Therefore, we set up this lecture series at Utrecht University in early 2016.
The guest lectures you will hear in this series come from different Dutch universities and have different disciplinary backgrounds. All speakers have in some way attributed to this discussion.
In this fourth lecture, you will hear Ruud Apma, social scientist at Utrecht University. An intro will be provided by Hieke Huistra, who works at the Utrecht University History and Philosophy of Science Department.
Welcome, everyone. Today our guest speaker is Ruud Apma, who works here at Utrecht University in the Faculty of Social Sciences. Many of you have probably seen him before, because he's a member of the Descartes Center as well, so the History and Philosophy of Science students should know him. And he works on the history of psychology and psychiatry. And on the social sciences more general, I would say. And one of the things he has done in recent years is written this book, The Kaartsepubliek, Location Factory, on the Stapel case and on research culture in the social sciences more general, scientific integrity. And that's what he's going to talk about today as well. Well, he's not going to talk about it, he's going to talk with us about it. And this is going to be a very interactive session, so do your duty and participate. Thank you.
Okay. Well, it all depends on you, of course, if it will be an interactive session. But one reason why I want to do is, first of all, this is you're all students in a research master and entitled to speak your own mind on the subjects that I bring up. And second, we are a small group, so we have a possibility to do so. And third, and maybe most important, for me, it is very helpful if I learn from you if things that I tell here land, so to speak. If you understand what I mean, if it's a subject of interest to you, etc. Because it would be a bit stupid to just, you know, speak my mind and you listen and then afterwards you have a discussion. So feel free to ask questions and interrupt or give a statement, because I have not the structure I have in mind is very simple. I will talk to you a bit about social sciences, because if you talk about, well, this course is about public perception of science, and this suggests that science is just one broad thing and it's approximately all the same. It's not. At the end of this afternoon, you will surely know that there are plenty of differences between the sciences, and that this affects also the public perception. And there's no such thing as the public. Well, those of you who were at the Science in Transition meeting know that, because plenty of the speakers say that, well, there's no such thing as the public, and you heard Trudy, who is very strong opinions about this as well.
I know.
This impresses me very much, because what can I add to the good things that Trudy probably, well, I disagree with her at some point, so maybe we'll come to that later. Let me start with a little anecdote, and this will put things immediately in perspective. It was on the 9th of September, it was a Friday, in 2011. And as usual, I went to my local bar to meet with my friends. I do that every Friday, if I can. And when I entered, they started laughing. Well, they do that more often, but this time they had a specific reason for that. They say, we do not understand how you dare come in here today. Okay. What's happening? Didn't you read about the social psychologist who committed fraud and even admitted that he had done so? A psychologist. You're in psychology, you're in the social sciences. My God, this is what a field you're working in. And they acted as if I was some sort of collaborator with Diederik Stapel and should be ashamed because he had committed fraud. I should be ashamed as well. And actually, the comment, underlying comment there was, actually, you're working in quite a ridiculous field. Your discipline, psychology, the social sciences, as an occupation and as a scientific field is not to be taken seriously. Now, well, in a way, the fact that I wrote this book has to do with that first encounter with public opinion on the social sciences related to the Stapel fraud case. This was not part of a publication plan. What happened was that people who knew, actually I was writing a book on a totally different subject and got published 3 months after that, which was on interdisciplinarity in the social sciences, which is a book that I use in teaching a course, which is called Over the Grenzen van Disciplines. So what happens when you cross boundaries between disciplines and how do these boundaries come about? So I was finishing that book and then this affair came up and so this is so illustrative of what's going on in social sciences, and I'll come to that later, what it's an illustration, that I thought I should do something with it. Shall I add it to the book that I'm finishing? Or maybe rather not, because in September, October of 2011, I was not quite certain that what was actually going on, what had been going on. So I decided to postpone it, but people kept asking me questions. What is, people from outside, the public, kept asking me and said, what is social psychology? Why do they do experiments? What kind of experiments are they? Did you know Diederik Stapel? Did you know what he was like? How is it possible that he could commit fraud for so long? That is a very important question. What do you think of the future of the social sciences? Now that this was not the only fraud case. 2 months later, there was a Rotterdam social psychologist who was also found out to have Dirk Smeesters done some tricks with his data and analysis. So this was the situation I was in, and I decided to use my blog. I had a blog with the book that was issued on the interdisciplinarity in the social science. I had a blog, and then I had some little bits and pieces on the Stapel fraud case. I was, you know, thinking out loud what's going on here, and this evolved into the book. Okay. First of all, when talking about the world of the sciences, what is your idea about where are psychology and the social science? Well, the first problem is what actually is part of the social sciences? Is psychology a social science? What do you think?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Social sciences is a administrative category for the most part. If you look worldwide, you see in some countries that economy is part of the social sciences. And in other countries, psychology, for instance, Holland, psychology is part of the social sciences. But it's not very self-evident. For instance, when you look at the name of my faculty, I'm working in the faculty in Dutch, the Faculteit Sociale Wetenschappen. But if you look at the English title of the faculty, it is called the Faculty of Social and Behavioral Sciences. Why is this? Because they would not want the Americans to think that psychology is nowhere. They want, if you say Faculty of Social Sciences, Americans will think, oh, it's, you know, like sociology, anthropology, etc. But psychology is somewhere else. But in our country, psychology is part of the social science. And this was a decision that was made in 1963. It was a decision, so it's not a natural thing. Does that sound strange to you, or?
Well,
that it was a decision?
To some extent, not really, because all the disciplinaries are sort of man-made, and I think that's also what Rens Boll argues for in his book about the humanities, that this distinction is just arbitrary.
Maybe it's not arbitrary, but there is some free space to negotiate where it is. Does any one of you know where psychology and also pedagogy were, in what faculty they were before the Faculty of Social Sciences was installed in 1963?
Maybe medicine?
No.
Humanities, maybe?
Actually, it was the Faculty of Philosophy and Literary Sciences. And that was, for psychology, not too strange, because if you are familiar a little bit with the history of psychology, well, you should always say then, and they made it sure to put it that way, psychology as an empirical science. Well, if you say that, you already know that there is a counterpart, which is psychology as a part of philosophy, which is thinking about what is a human being, how does the mind work, etc. All these sorts of questions about mind-body problematics, ethical questions, perception. This has all been part, for ages, been part of philosophy. And at the end of the 19th century, there were some clever philosophers who thought, well, if I want to be special, already at that age people wanted to be special and say, do something new. Say, if we have, for instance, research questions on how the mind works, how perception works, how memory works. Of course, we could, you know, sit in our chair and think about it, but we could also try and do some experiments. And experimental work was then very popular. The natural sciences were entering the universities, had been entering the universities for more than half a century at that point. I'm talking late 19th century now. And so it's not too strange that psychologists borrow methods from physiologists and physicists to try and understand how does perception work, how do people respond to stimuli, etc. So there, at that point, around 1900, there came a new type of psychologists who were still in philosophy, formally speaking, but did experimental research on all sorts of aspects of the human psyche. And actually, this was the first period that the experiment became some sort of, I think that Guambo said that quite right, that psychologists thought it would be prestigious to lend towards the natural sciences. And ever since then, psychologists, not all of them, but some, have always returned to the idea, if we want to be a real, proper behavioral science, we need to do experiments. And the echo of this you see in the Stapel fraud case, because the social this is a type of social psychology which is experimental social psychology. Okay? Any questions so far? Does this sound strange to you? Why would psychologists do experiments?
Why not? If you can.
Because you can. It's like the Mount Everest, because it's there. Why don't you want to? Yeah. No. That's not the real good answer, I would say.
It applies to all other methods as well.
I don't know, but like historians would love to do experiments, but they can't. So maybe they...
Well, this is interesting. This is debatable. If it's possible to... Well, it is possible to do experiments in psychology, but is it useful? That's a different question. So we'll come to that later. But the reason I'm telling you all this is that... if you talk about the way people think and perceive and remember things and all this, how they differ from one another, how you can assess whether someone else is trustworthy or nice or evil, etc. These are all things that we do, as citizens, all day. And I'm telling you this because maybe we can discuss this, but my statement here would be social scientists on the whole investigate aspects of human beings that we all assess during the day as well. So they have an extra task when they come out with their research plans and their research results. Can anyone think along with me and tell me what is the extra challenge for the social sciences?
I'd say they will have to create some distance towards their subject. But they are their subject themselves, in a way. So they are, and in that case, experiments would come in handy because that would be a tool to do so.
You're already two steps further than I had planned, but that's good.
They also have to prove stuff, right?
Sorry?
They have to prove stuff.
Yeah.
Which we normally, things we do every day, you have to take it out of the normal context and put it into maybe a laboratory and prove that it actually happens or try to find out how it happens.
Okay, anyone else? Because there's more to it.
I think also because there are things that other people already observe in everyday life, they have sort of preconceived notion of what's happening or what.
Yeah.
So they have to challenge this notion that everybody already has.
That's it. That's true, yeah. Now, some of you said, well, this is why psychologists have to do experiments, because if they want to, you know, prove to the lay audience that what they have to offer is more insightful, more solid, etc., than what human beings usually think of themselves and others. Yes. For the part it's true, but actually the psychologist that was the most influential psychologist ever did not do any experiments. Who was he? It was a he. Sigmund Freud, yeah. Of course, he was not a psychologist in the sense that we would say now. What was his background? What was he?
A doctor, I think.
That's, yeah?
Medical doctor.
Yeah. That's true. He was a medical doctor. And what was his specialization?
Drugs.
Sorry?
Drugs.
Drugs? Well, he used drugs, but... No one read debug.
Sorry, I say psychiatry, but I don't know whether it already exists.
Well, that is the usual. That is the usual answer, and it's the wrong answer. No, he was a neurologist, and he did laboratory research for the first part of his career. And I will not make this into a long story, but it's significant that he worked in a laboratory. He tried to get in as a teacher and a researcher into the university in Vienna, but he did not succeed. And some biographers say this has to do with the fact that he was Jewish, and that may be true. But he had to... create for himself a private practice as a neurologist to get some income and be able to get married. So it's as simple as that. So he had a practice, private practice in Vienna, the Berggasse. The house is still there. It's a museum now. Go and visit it if you're there. And he had patients that paid him privately, private patients, and they had all sorts of complaints about their, they had pains, they had problems in concentrating, all sorts of what we would now call vague diseases. And he found out at some point that just talking about how long have do you have this? Where did it? Can you find out where did it originate, etc.? Because there were no physical problems to be found in these patients, not at least in some of them. So he came up with the theory that there were mental problems in these patients, and talking with these patients could help to, you know, alleviate the symptoms and maybe even cure the patient. He actually explicitly talked in a medical language about all this, that these patients were ill, even if it's mental, and they could be cured, etc. Interestingly, but I will keep this brief, and if you have questions, please... mention that to me. What he did was write up his case studies and try to see if there's a pattern. He made a theory about what it is that, how the human psyche is structured. And he said, well, for the most part, what happens there is unconscious. And it's not the unconscious things that we would have today. There's part of social psychology, which is talking a lot about unconscious. Maybe you have heard of Ab Dijksterhuis, a social psychologist from Nijmegen, who wrote a very nice, interesting book on Het slimme onbewuste, the clever unconscious. But it's a totally different unconscious than what Freud was. Because in Freud, and you might keep that in mind, in Freud's work, it's what is unconscious is conflict. Conflict between what you want and what you're allowed to do, for instance. So it's an emotional conflict that is in the is repressed into the unconscious. It's totally different from the experimental research that is done now in social psychology. Okay, so Freud was terribly influential in Europe, in the United States, and why? What was the? How can you determine what his influence was? Anyone? Why? Well, in what way was he influential? this calls for some historical perspective.
That a lot of the notions and concepts we still use today to think about human mind, human emotions,
yeah,
and culture come directly out of his work.
It's about language, of course.
Yes.
It's about language and concepts. And what you have, if you read Freud's work, it's a very refined theoretical work. Well, it's like this. There's a Dutch translation issued in 2006 of the complete works of Sigmund Freud. It's like this. And it's very interesting to read it. It starts with the early works and ends with the works that he wrote in his last years when he was in his 80s. And you see how the work develops. It's very interesting. It's very sophisticated. But when you see how it has trickled down into the public, you see that's there. Okay, everything you do has to do with, you know, sex. And there are stages in sexuality, and young boys want to kill their father and have sex with their mother. Yes, there's a super ego and an ego, and they both repress things that come from the unconscious, etc. So this is the primitive, popular version of what's in Freud. And it has influenced our way of thinking tremendously. And I have to add another aspect to that as well, which is that if you have mental problems, you can do something about it. So you see a transference from the religious domain to the scientific domain, as it were, or to the medical domain. Because if in a religious domain, if something happens to you, you're possessed by demons, or you have to accept the suffering that the good Lord is putting on you. And ever since Freud, if you are depressed or have some other psychological problem, you know that there are experts who can help you to deal with it. So that's totally different. You don't have to accept suffering. You don't have to accept mental suffering. I think that's the main change that Freud has made for Western culture.
Was that new? Were there?
Yeah.
Nothing like psychiatry or idea that things like hysteria or something could be treated.
Thank you for mentioning this. The problem at that period, I mean, I'm talking about 1900 again. What you had were mental institutions, psychiatrische inrichtingen, gekkenhuizen, lunatic asylums. And these were people that had actually very serious, grave problems, like we would now say schizophrenia or very severe depressions. In these mental institutions, there were doctors. They had medical doctors, and they also had medical doctors that had specialized in psychiatry. So they knew something about mental disorders. But they could not treat them. They did not have a clue what was going on. Their idea was, there's something wrong with the brain of these patients. But different from nowadays, you could not look into the brain. You could not put these in an MRI scanner and check if there's something going on in the brain and that still goes for today, even if you see that there's something happening in the brain that's not normal, it's questionable if you can do something about it. So, to answer David's question, there were psychiatrists, but they were not able to help people, and not really help them in a psychological way. What they had was ways to restrain psychiatric patients. So restrain them in a physical way with, I don't know the words for that, but you know, like a dwangbuis.
Straight jacket,
that's the word, thank you. Or cold baths, or another form of restraint was moral restraint. So you would have a psychiatric institution, you would have the director of the institution would be like a father to the patients. And this fatherhood would, you know, go down on the personnel, the doctors, and they would all be, you know, like a big family. And you could organize the rhythm of the days and the task that had to be done. They would have their psychiatric patients work, and work would be an activity that would, you know, create order in the lives of these unruly patients. But that was not real psychotherapy. So Freud was really the first one to have an idea of, if you talk to patients and if you listen to patients, you might be able to, in the dialogue, to find out what's wrong with them and help them to alleviate the symptoms. I have to say that the patients that Freud encountered were different from the patients in the psychiatric wards, because the psychiatric patients were more seriously disturbed than the patients that Freud. It's a difference between what Freud had was neurotic patients. They would, you know, be able to function more or less in a normal way, but they would have some forms of deviant behavior, and they knew it, which is different from a real psychiatric patient, because they will not, these would usually not know that there was something wrong with them, which is called something like self-insight or self-awareness of a patient. So that's different. Freud had different patients. These patients were also what we now call ambulant patients. They would, you know, come into the session and talk with Freud and then go back home and think about it and then come back the next day, because it was usually five or six times a week that they would come to the session. Okay. How did psychoanalysis relate to empirical psychology? Anyone? If you would say it in terms of a power balance.
It was probably bigger. The only thing I know is that it was also popular in philosophy around the end of the 19th century.
What was popular in philosophy?
Psychology. So they wanted to expect, for example, Deleuze wants to use psychology to explain the human condition.
Yes.
But that does not have anything to do with empirical experience.
No, as a matter of fact, Deleuze had a problem with that, because he said everything that has to do with the human mind should be approached rather with, you know, mutual understanding and talking to one another than doing experiments, because you would objectify the person, and you would actually, you would treat the person as if he were the same as a natural object, like a rock or star or whatever, and you would, you know, ignore the fact that he or she has feelings and thoughts, etc. And thank you for saying this, because this I can immediately jump forward now to a problem with experimental social psychology, as Dietrich Stapel and his colleagues do it. And also relate that to a special relationship of the social sciences to the public. Maybe I can best illustrate this by referring to the Milgram experiments. You're all familiar with the work of Stanley Milgram. There will be a new movie out within 2 weeks on the life and work of Stanley Milgram. The Milgram experiment.
Can someone explain it?
Yeah.
I think it was an experiment where people were instructed to inflict harm on other subjects.
Yes.
And we wanted to see how far people would go in inflicting harm on other human beings.
How far did they go?
Very far.
Anyone something to add to this?
The reason would be that they were instructed to do so, that we would simply follow the orders to do it.
And it was also, the pain was not actually inflicted, but it was acted by actors?
Yes.
So this was more on the people who were instructed to do the things by people who were in lab coats than actually the experiment that was being performed, so to say, as such.
Very good. Very good. Yeah. That's true. Are you convinced by the results of these experiments? The result being that if you impress people enough, they might, you know, do things that go against their conscience. That's the result.
I'm convinced.
You're convinced?
Because it matches observations outside science.
Like?
Like people in war situations, in all sorts of regimes.
Yeah.
So then I don't know if I trust the setup of the experiment. I trust the outcome because it matches something that I expected.
The interesting thing is that Stanley Milgram had a hard time in getting these results. He was a young man when he did these experiments. It was 1961, 1962. He was 28 years old at the time, and he wanted to make a mark in science, in social psychology. He was impressed by the work of Solomon Asch and Leon Festinger and Kurt Lewin. And he thought, well, I want to be famous as well. I want to do something really exciting. And keep this in mind. When we think about Dietrich Stapel later on, you will recognize the feeling that you would want to do something that is exciting, that will get you in the newspapers, that will give you a special place within your discipline. He came up with the idea of doing this. It took a while, because he was struck. He wanted to repeat the experiments that were done by Solomon Asch. Maybe you heard of that. That you have a group like this in a room, and you project lines on a screen, and they're different. The length is different, but then you have a few people that you have organized. They are on your side and say, no, actually they're the same. And then you manage to get the group finally to think that, okay, these lines are equally long. And Milgram wanted to do something like that. Social pressure on human beings might help you to, might make them think alike, make them do things that they would, as an individual, not do. So you create a situation. But he tried to do that with the equipment that he had, and administering shocks to people to make them learn better, etc. But it didn't work at first. So we had really to make like a theatrical production to make these things work. And then it happened, but not in all the conditions. So I will not, you know, mention all of the things that are a problem with these experiments. But one thing is interesting, because David said, well, this is what you can expect if you talk and see what people do in war situations. You can imagine that in specific social situations, people would, you know, commit cruelties. But when interviewed before the experiments, a group of experts, psychiatrists and psychologists, would say, well, people will not do that. They will not, you know, go to the limits of the administering shocks when put under pressure. They will not do that. Their conscience, their human, well, the fact that they're human and care for other humans will not, they will not inflict these pains on other patients, on other persons. A couple of years ago, a psychologist, an Australian psychologist and journalist, who was, like all psychology students, are impressed by the Milgram experiments. This is a real good experiment. Well, actually, it's not. But I'll come back to that later. But it's a sort of landmark within the field of psychology. It's the most famous psychological experiment, and it's within social psychology. So this is good for social psychology because it immediately was put on the map as a serious science. This journalist / psychologist, Gina Perry, was intrigued by the question, what had happened to these people that had participated in these experiments? If I would be able to interview them, I could find out how they would look back upon this period in their life, because she had some information that not for all the persons that had participated in these experiments, it was had been a pleasure. And she went over to the United States and interviewed some people, and then found out that the complete tapes of all the sessions, and there were many sessions, there were about 25 to 30 sessions, they were all taped, some were even videotaped. And that they were open for research. And she also found out that the notebooks that Milgram kept himself were open for inspection. So what she did was do a total investigation of these experiments. And then she found out that the standard view, the received view that was in the psychology textbooks, was rather different from what Milgram actually did. He staged the complete experiment in a way to get these results. And if we changed the conditions, the result would not be that 65% of the people would, you know, go to the highest voltage on the machine. So what I'm telling you this is that we tend to think that doing an experiment is the highest form of research, because, well, why would that be? Have you discussed that before, why experiments are so important?
Because they are replicable.
Ah, yeah, well, if they are, yes.
Well, good experiments should be replicable.
Should be, yeah, sure. But there's something else about experiments that is that people always say about them.
And objective?
Objective, of course. But they do something else.
You can test the hypothesis.
Yes, and what? Yes. You can do that, and there's some you can establish something for sure with an experiment.
Truth? Facts.
No. How shall I put this question differently without giving away the answer? What you want to do when you do science, you want to understand something. You want when you see a phenomenon, you want to know where it comes from. So what you want to do is establish a causal relationship. That's what experiments are supposed to do. But how do experiments do that? What is necessary for an experiment to work?
Independent of a dependent variable?
Yeah, well, but that's, yeah, okay, but that's not, okay, you have to independent, what about the other variables?
Yeah, you have to, try to mitigate all the other variables.
Yeah, neutralize them, keep them constant, etc. Yes?
Control.
Control, yeah. So this is what you do when you have an experiment. You will say, I want to know what the effect is of this variable on another one. And all the other disturbing things that can be in the situation, I want to leave them out because I want to know exactly if this is causing that. Well, that's a sensible thing to think. But there's two problems. The first one is that if you have a situation where you have your independent variable and say, okay, this is A and A causes B, the fact that every time you do A, you get B is not really per se a causal relationship. What is needed for a causal relationship?
Observer that sees the
relationship. Yes, there's something else you need. What you do here is you do not necessarily have a causal, you have a correlation. Whenever A, you have B. That's a correlation. But you need something else to have a causal relationship. Or not?
One precedes the other?
No.
Nothing else explains the outcome of B?
Well, you're getting somewhere, yeah.
Full information? Like past, present, future?
No, what you need to know is what is the mechanism that explains why A and B are always together. You need to have a theory to make it understandable why A always causes B. So and it's not enough to establish that these things. So that is one thing. You need a theory, and you need a theory on a mechanism that explains this thing. The second problem is, and this goes especially for the social sciences, but I think in the natural sciences it's something to think about as well, that you need to be sure what kind of disturbing variables you need to suppress. In the Milgram experiment, what you need to do is, there is a variety of people coming in the experiments. Actually, these were not, as usual, usually in psychological experiments, you have psychology students as subjects of the research. But Milgram did something different. He recruited citizens from New Haven, which is close to the Yale University where he was working. And these people he wanted to make sure that they would be very different from one another. But he had a problem in soliciting enough subjects, so he was happy with anyone who would, you know, join the experiment. And they were totally different. They came in with their own life history, with their own experience, with their own anxieties and preferences, and he had to create a situation where they would all be more or less alike. So this was suppressing a lot of disturbing variables for him to do. Did it work? That's a bit of, according to his own account of the experiments, it worked. But according to the more sophisticated, detailed analysis by Gina Perry 50 years later, It did not work too well. In the movie, it will be in the cinemas in a couple of weeks. In the movie, you see one example where it does make a difference. One person, one young man, refused to administer shocks above a certain level. And the the proofreader, the one that was in charge,
Principal investigator.
No, well, he was not the principal. Okay. He was the guy that would stand there and say to the so-called teacher who would administer shock. He would say, whenever they would be hesitant, he would say, "No, you have to go on. Please carry on. It's important for this investigation that you continue. Please continue." And this guy was refused to continue because he would administer shocks that were, let's say, above 50 volts. Why would he stop? Why did he refuse? He worked in electrotechnics. He was familiar with the effect of shocks and how nasty they were. And he, from his own experience, and he said, "Well, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to go any further. It's bad for people." So the fact that people come in the experiment with their own experiences. There was another one who would, he would go to the end with the highest voltages. Why? Because he thought, "I'm being tricked. It is not possible that a solid university like Yale would, endanger in an experimental situation people's lives with administering shocks. I have the feeling that something else is being experimented upon, namely myself. So I don't care really about the theater that is being staged here. I just go on and go along with the, but I don't believe a word from the official definition of this situation." This came out only later. Okay.
I have a question, because in this last case, I understand how that undermines the outcome of if someone sees through the experiment.
Yeah.
But the first thing, that people come in with different life stories, I don't understand why that's a problem and why that needs to be neutralized. Isn't that part of the theory?
Yeah.
Or couldn't that just be part of theory? Okay, this, if you also the staging, staging is part of the experiment.
Yeah.
So if you put people in the right kind of theatrical setting and pressure them in a theatrical way, then some percentage, I'm sure the claim was not 100%,
yes,
will do it, and that depends.
Yes.
Depends on all sorts of things, but is that important?
Well, yes, it is important, not for the outcome of the experiment per se, but the next step. When you have this thing published, and Milgram did this, he would... the interesting thing is that in these days, after World War II, there was a debate on how is it possible that Germany created so many Nazis, that so many people would, follow orders and go along with Hitler and his regime. And the received wisdom was that, this is because they're Germans. It's in their culture to obey. And what Milgram, and that this is why it was such a shock in the United States when his results came out, what Milgram said was, "No, the Nazis are among us. We are all Nazis. If we're brought in this situation, we will all do as the teacher or the experimenter tells you." Is that true? Well, in the experiment, it's true, but this, you cannot as easily turn it around and say, "Okay, so now we know that people, in general, you just put some pressure on them and they will follow orders." If that's a conclusion, that's debatable. Because in the experiment, I speed it up now a little bit, because otherwise I'll be too long about the experimental social psychology. In the experiment, the situation is very tight. There's actually no time to really reflect on what's going on, and there is hardly any opportunity for negotiating. Either you continue or you step out. Is that a natural situation that we encounter normally when we are asked to do a thing? Or this actually has to do with scientific integrity a lot. Normally when we are pressed to do something and we have a feeling, this is not right, I don't want to do this, you create almost automatically some time to think about it or to discuss it with someone you trust. That's a normal thing. So if you're, suppose you're working in a scientific department and your supervisor asks you to, well, you do the experiments and there are some results that are not, you know, too good, but if you leave some subject out, some results out, then you get a perfect picture. And you say, well, this is, you can do this because it's, you know, methodologically it's very safe and sound to do that. You would be in a limbo. You would be thinking, well, okay, if he says he's my supervisor and he knows how it's done, and on the other hand, it doesn't feel right. I don't trust the results of this. This is not a good experiment. But can you say that? Well, what you do then, usually, is to talk it over with someone else and say, okay, what would you do? Some of your peers. So that is this is bridge to the second part of my talk. The Milgram situation is not a natural situation. That is a bit of a problem. So if you would, you know, generalize this to all human situations, say, okay, if you put people under pressure, they can only do one thing, comply or walk out. Well, that's not true. They could discuss it with someone else, and you could oppose your supervisor and say, I'm not going to do that. I think this is not very good. Okay. To summarize, the problem with experimental social psychology is that, yes, it can be done. You can do the experiments, but what do they mean? And this was, and are they sensible? Are they meaningful? Are they a good representation of what the social relations that we have in everyday life? And to make a shortcut, my statement is that actually this kind of social psychology is mainly addressing other social psychologists. So the meaning of these experiments is internal. Primarily internal. The research agenda is made by the social psychologists themselves, and they discuss among each other. Is this a problem? Yes and no. Yes, it is a problem because there is no penetration of outside opinions on the research agenda, which may mean that, and this is actually what happens, that it's a self-indulgent community. And you have those communities everywhere in the scientific world, of course, but I hope you accept from me that when you talk about social sciences or psychology, it's different. If researchers concentrate on things that they find interesting and get their money to do the research, but it has no real meaning or significance to the outside world, you are not, you know, helping the understanding of the public in what's going on.
Is it the point that when you do experiments, if you want to do a proper experiment, you have to suppress all the factors other than the ones you're investigating, and exactly because of that you create an unnatural situation that can never tell you something about society?
That's one thing, but the other thing is about the priorities on the research agenda. What is one big problem nowadays? That is that we have people coming over from the Middle East to Europe, and a debate on where should we leave them? How will we put them up? Is there a danger for our women and children from young men from Syria? All these are social questions that are very important and very debated. And the interesting thing is that not many social scientists actually are on the forefront of these debates. It's journalists, it's historians, it's Beatrice de Graaf, of course. But you do not see social psychologists debating it. And why is that? Because they would say, well, there are no good results from our investigations that we can use to, you know, explain and help interpret what's going on here and what are the dangers. So their research agenda is not suited to thinking and help thinking about the actual issues of a multicultural Europe.
Is that also because, what I, as a completely late person on this view, observe or remark when I read about those experiments in the paper, because they want to do experiments, they mostly look into very short-term effects?
Yes, and also...
Very limited and very, couldn't say anything about longer-term relations.
Yes, and also, well, one big problem is also that there is the historians among you might recognize this, there is some sort of watershed between social sciences and history writing, historical investigations. Let's limit that to, for instance, sociology. If you look into the history of the sciences, you will notice that there's a lot of common ground between history and sociology. But they became divided at some point when... And maybe that is Diltai around the same time that one group said, okay, no, what we have to do is make theories and test them and do empirical research and go for structures. What are the structures of society as one big machine, like nature is seen as one, you know, connected big machine, and we might be able to find the fabric, to investigate the fabric of society, and have some generalizing theories about how this thing works, society. And then historians would say, no, well, this is not what we are doing. Our idea is not to have general laws of society, but to investigate contingencies. So things happen and they cause other things, and you cannot... The difference would be that sociologists would want to predict what's going on, and certainly psychologists would want to do that, and historians would say, well, things happen and we will try to make sense of what has happened afterwards. That's the main difference. But the problem is that this has led to an almost total neglect of historical factors by social scientists. They do not want to be informed about historical developments. Okay, so this is I don't know if it's a good answer to your question, but there's it's not just the fact that they do experiments and necessarily have a very limited time frame and very they have to narrow down their conditions, because of course when you analyze from a historical point of view, you know there are so many factors involved in what's if you have an event like, for instance, the murder on Pim Fortuyn. Well, try and see what actually is in what has led to that murder. Of course, you have Volkert van G, but there's also a climate in which there's an image. Pim Fortuyn is on center stage in the media, etc., and there is some sort of general disgust among the public of traditional politics, which is still there now, and Geert Wilders benefits from that. But if you want to analyze what's going on, you there's nothing to be gained from looking into social psychology and say, okay, we have a general law within social psychology that if there is a high amount of critique on traditional politics, that this may lead to a situation where an oppositional figure like Pim Fortuyn has more chances of being killed. This is not the way. So this type of social psychology does not help you very much in understanding what's going on. Shall I go back to the theme of integrity and fraud, because you have been reading about that, and it's supposed to be the subject of today. One thing, there are a couple of things very special about the case of Diederik Stapel, and they might illustrate also the general issues that are involved when you talk about fraud and scientific integrity. First of all, the case is unique in that Diederik Stapel confessed to his fraud. Normally, and you have seen the review by Lewontin of this book, Great Betrayal. Oh, I can pass it around. Almost in every case, you see that the one who is accused of fraud denies that it's fraud, denies having been involved, denies that it's malpractice in one way or another. And Diederik Stapel confessed, and he promised to work along with the investigative committee. It is not clear to me, and probably not even to Diederik Stapel himself, why he confessed. I have the impression that he actually was relieved that he was found out. If you look in the pattern of his fraud, you see that it started with, and that is, you see that more often, it started with what I would call photoshopping of the results, of the experimental results, making them somewhat nicer. And there are techniques for that, statistical techniques that up until a certain point they are allowed. You can, when you do an experiment and you have so-called outliers, which are results that are totally out of tune with the rest, say, well, there's probably something wrong with that subject in the research. So there might be a person that is, you know, just filling in, rambling at random, or behaving weirdly, and you can decide to leave these people out of your table, and then your results are better interpretable. According to the methodological books, what you should do if you want to do a proper experiment is that you say beforehand what kind of outliers you would exclude. So you would have to say, well, if it's a person in the experiment that does this or writes down that, we consider it to be an outlier, not as a subject that we can use. But in many, many cases in the human sciences, this is not done beforehand. It's the decision is afterward. But this is considered an acceptable practice, removing the outliers, cleaning up the data. But the second step is making the data more beautiful. There you enter the situation. What Diederik Stapel did was, when there were some figures that were not quite, he would change the figure by hand. And of course he was quite nervous that he would be found out in the beginning. He wrote a book about his own history. And of course you cannot trust everything he writes in the book, because he has a very good fantasy. But whenever things in that book are in the same line as other information on what he has done, you can accept his own explanation. He actually panicked at some point and changed a few figures. He would be found out. And guess what? Nobody noticed. And there, this is my reconstruction. So it could have been different, but if you see the pattern, he went from bad to worse. He took ever more risks. When he worked in Groningen, after his dissertation, he came there, and he was the golden boy of social psychology, actually. I had never heard of him. There were social psychologists in the Netherlands which were far more famous than he was, but apparently among the younger generation he was very important and was seen as, he knows what to do. He has always good results. He has he has a knack of doing experiments. He's very good at, he knows the tricks to do a good experiment. So when he came to Groningen, he worked together with some people and the experiments failed. Now, here, this mark my choice of words here. Can an experiment fail? Is that possible that an experiment fails? Well, what does that mean?
It doesn't produce the result that you were hoping for.
Right. So this is only human, that if you think about something and you say, okay, I think the situation, whenever you put people in a room and pressure them to administer shocks to them, I expect that they will do this. And then you get a totally different result, or you get something you cannot interpret. Okay, well, what do you do? You say, you have a bad day, and then you start all over again, or you're going to do something else. But you can also decide to, you do the experiment once more, and another time, another time, and then actually you do the experiment 10 times. And two of the occasions you get the result that you expect, that you desire to get, and the other 8 you didn't. Well, of course it's possible to make a publication and only include the last two situations, the experiments that produce the result that you wanted, and do not talk about the other eight. Now, is that a sign of integrity? No, it's not.
I'm glad you
finally. No, but it's...
On the other hand, that happened all the time when at school I did in physics or chemistry experiment, and it always would go wrong in a... Well, usually in a clear way that you could see what went wrong, but not always. And you knew what
of course. Of course. When an experiment fails, what you do is... Did I do something wrong? That's the first question that you ask, because you're so convinced that the result should be produced. I did something wrong. The conditions were not orchestrated well, etc., etc. So, and maybe you will accept from me that the situation in the natural sciences. Although, as David says, there you get have the problem as well. But that in the human sciences, the situation is even more complex, and because the results of your experiment are also determined by what the people in your experiment actually think they are doing in the experiment. So they have their own interpretation of what's going on. And you do not know that unless you ask them afterward, for instance. So if you are doing experiments in the human sciences, like Dietrich Stapel did, actually you should always have a follow-up interview with all the subjects in your experiment and ask them what they were, how they did you interpret the situation, would you think that was going on, the results of the experiments are like this, can you understand that, do you agree with that, etc. Actually, this interview after the experiment was, mostly not done. People do not do that, but it was the most famous methodologist from the Netherlands within the social sciences. Would anyone know who that is? He wrote a book called Methodology in the early 60s. No one knows? Adriaan de Groot, A.D. de Groot. He was also the man that thought of the CITO, organization that does the standardized tests for school pupils.
Design school exams.
So in the human sciences, you really need to know what people actually think. Although you, in the experiment, you treat them as if they are all equal, you know that they're not. So it's useful for your interpretation of the results of the experiment to know if they believed the situation of the experiments, if they accepted what was your story about what is going on. But that's hardly ever done. Okay, where was I? I was with Dietrich Stapel. The interesting thing is, he was scared that he would be found out, and he wasn't. Although, every once in a while, he wrote with co-authors and with PhD students. And you might guess that, well, who would be in the position to find out what was if he was cheating, the co-authors or the PhD students would be the most easily
well, the way it was described in the parts.
Yeah.
I think it was by the PhD students because they had to enter the data into computers, but he always did it himself or let someone else do it. So I didn't actually see the creation of the data, so to say.
Yeah. What he did was... one thing of people who commit fraud in science is that they create a situation where they cannot be controlled. So people will not, you know, watch their fingers when they do something. And we all, this may be a difference between the sciences and the humanities, but within the sciences, it's usually said, well, we are a team, it's teamwork. And you will discuss later on if there's some sort of self-cleaning or self-cleansing capacity of science. And they always say, no, you work together and people will know from one another what they're doing. So you cannot commit fraud. From the history, and that's in this book, The Great Betrayal, are many cases that people sometimes have good ways of isolating themselves at crucial moments, working late in the lab, coming very early to the lab when no one is there, or as Dietrich Stapel did, and say, no, I cannot take you to the schools where I do my research with the pupils there because I have a very delicate relationship with the schools, and if I take too many people along, they will, you know, be annoyed and maybe refuse future participation in this type of experiment. Dietrich Stapel worked alone. He worked together with co-authors who were not in his field. So that's very clever. Say, okay, I'm an experimental social psychology. Why not work together with someone from personality psychology? And I would, you know, and he was very good at finding a little bridge to connect the themes that they would be interesting in. So he would, you know, say, okay, we work together on a publication, and I will do the experiments, and then we'll, you know, draw up together the theoretical framework and then write the article, etc. And he would never show his data to the other persons. And they would accept that. They would say, okay, well, I don't want to be bothered with the data anyway because I don't have much time and I will discuss with you a few times, etc. So this is the day-to-day basis that it... And with his PhD students, it was somewhat different. He would... which is totally counter, well, what you call that? Not counterfactual, but counter your expectation. That normally you would have a professor and who would let all the PhD students do the work, right? So gather the data, do the initial analyses, and then he would come along and say, no, it's not good, do it again. And Dietrich Stapel was totally different. He would go then himself to gather the data. He would come up with the first tables and analyses and then would leave the writing of the whole article to PhD students, submit it to the journal, and when the journal would have comments, he would, you know, handle that this one way or another. If they say, well, the results are not good, he would, you know, do something with the results, say, okay, now they're good, and then the article can be published. This went further when he went to Tilburg. He left Groningen, that was his, from 2000 to 2006, he worked in Groningen, and after the initial dip that his experiments failed, he would start to Photoshop his results and change his data and change the statistical analysis a little bit. He knew how to manipulate that and was successful. successful enough to make the step to Groningen and get a very good position there with lots of extra money to build up a research group, and he would, within a couple of years, be heading a joint institute between social sciences and economics. And he would also finally become the dean of the faculty of social sciences. And he still would have all these PhD students work with him. And also co-authors from other universities, like Sigmund Lindenberg, who was a very famous senior sociologist in Groningen, who had become famous with an article in Science that whenever there's a messy environment, people would be more prone to stereotyping. And, that's very interesting. I can connect it with things from social psychology. So would these people not be also willing to, you know, be more against the... would they be easier discriminate among, you know, white people and black people? And he thought of an experiment that he would, a field experiment that he would do in Central Station when there was a strike going on in 2010, and claimed that he had, you know, actually put people on a bench sitting next to a black person and see that they would, you know, be further, sit further away from the black person whenever there was a messy environment. And he said, well, the control condition a couple of months later when there was no strike going on and everything was neat and clean. Totally made up. Totally. From beginning to end. And it was published in Science. And actually, one of the reviewers was Ab Dijksterhuis, the one I mentioned earlier, who was one of the reviewing editors. And a reviewing editor is one that decides if the paper is sent on to other real, more sophisticated reviewers. So that was the first selection. And he would say, well, this is very interesting. This is very good. I have no reason to doubt whatever is going on here. So Diederik Stapel was very good at faking the data because he knew what type of data, what type of experiment, what type of theory was acceptable within his field.
Isn't this one of those cases where community report requires as much creativity and skill as
Absolutely. Well, actually, that was a comment that Paul Schnabel wrote on the back of the book here. So, Wiedabma shows that only a true scientist can produce fake science in a credible manner, but also that the best results should be trusted the least. So this is the sentence that you see in all these books on, I pass it around too. This is a book written by Kees Schuit between mistakes, honest mistakes and fraud. And he was the chair of the National Institute that would, you know, investigate cases of fraud that were brought on by universities. And he has, by the way, very interesting comments on the code of conduct. And I see that you had some comments on that too. Well, yes, it's. But apart from that, Diederik Stapel really didn't know what kind of results would be acceptable for the journals. The point that I want to make here, and that is, I said there were a couple of things that made a difference in the Stapel case. One of them was that Diederik Stapel confessed. The other one was that the committee that investigated the fraud did two things that are not normal. One is, all of the publications of Diederik Stapel were investigated. Normally, you only look at the publications where someone says, well, they're fraudulent, and keep it at that. Why is that? Because it's a terrible amount of work. If you have, in this case, it were about 150 journal articles by Diederik Stapel. If you, in every respect, you have to see that you get the raw data, see that you get the clean data, see that you are able to replicate the analyses. You need to reconstruct the steps from the analysis to the paper. And you need, well, you need your documentation, but you also need to interview the people who were involved in the research to understand what actually had been going on. It's a terrible amount of work. To put this into perspective, and in more than one way, is that in almost the same time, at almost the same time that Diederik Stapel was found out, there was medical professor Don Polemans from Rotterdam, Erasmus University in Rotterdam, where it was found out that, and this was far more serious actually than what Diederik Stapel, because he had been doing research into medication for heart problems, and he had, you know, fake data and in a comparable way to Diederik Stapel, but it was the Erasmus University, contrary to the Tilburg University, did not decide to have all these things, all the publications, and they were, I think, three times as many as Diederik Stapel, so it was that couldn't be done. And to put this into perspective as well, when Diederik Stapel was found out, there were all comments all over the place that social psychology is bunk, that social sciences are not real, not to be taken seriously, all on ignited by the Stapel case, but no one said, well, let's put an end to internal medicine because of the fraud of Don Polemans. They said, well, he's the rotten apple, and he did something wrong, but the rest is okay. And in spite of the fact that all the social psychologists said, well, Diederik Stapel, we never trusted him, and we actually did something quite right. We were honest, and he was, you know, dishonest. The public, in the case of the social sciences, said, well, we didn't trust the social sciences anyway. So this is another instance of the problematic relation, or the extra challenge, as I mentioned it earlier, the extra challenge that social sciences have to come to be trusted by and to be respected by the public. Do I make myself clear? Okay, as I said, the Leveld Committee did two things that were special. All the publications were analyzed, and they tried to answer the question, how is it possible, and that's also unusual for a committee to do that, how is it possible that he got away with it for so long? It is quite probable that he had been doing at least the photoshopping of his experiments in the period that he was a PhD student in Amsterdam. There it started. It cannot be actually proven, but there is evidence that he did that. And why couldn't it be proven? Because there were no raw data to redo the analysis. And in the Groningen period, there were still the raw data, so you could really do the calculations over again. And then you could have the actual proof that he, you know, changed, well, in each step he did something to change the results in his favor. How is it possible that, how could he get away with it for so long? He manipulated. He chose his co-authors so that they would not be familiar with his way of working, the way of working of social psychology, and they would not ask questions. He chose his PhD students, some in some co-publications he did with them, with some of the students he would, and most of the students he would, you know, commit fraud with the data. In some he did not. And it's interesting to, I have not found the real answer why he did not enter into fraud with some of the PhD students. Maybe they were too clever or too resistant, or they were not of interest to him, subject-wise. The answer of the Leveld committee on the question, how could he get away with it for so long, is eventually that there was no true critical environment in the subdiscipline of experimental social psychology. People would not actually critically read the stuff that people were writing. They would not ask questions during the research, during the various steps of the research. There is a tradition of leaving out experiments that did not work. So making the publication say, okay, well, I had 3 or 4 experiments which gave this result, and the rest we don't talk about. They were very problematic. There's no tradition, not a real good tradition of replication or reproduction of experiments in social psychology. And if experiments are reproduced, like for instance in famous priming experiments, priming means that you have your subjects in your experiments, introduce them into a certain mood, and then have them do an extra task which is not told to them what it's about, so they would be unconsciously influenced to do something. And this is a very tricky technique. It's very, in order to do this very well, you have to be very sophisticated, very clever, and it's very, very hard to replicate this type of experiment. So, and whenever it is done, and the results are not in agreement with the earlier experiment, there is a big debate on what's going on. Well, this replication was done by people who are not very good at doing this type of experiment. So you would discredit the other experimenter if your results don't show up in another experiment. And so this is a situation where when you have a result in your experiment which is novel, which is exciting, which can be published in a scientific journal. One of my surprises was that serious scientific journals would be as eager to have something spectacular in their columns as a journal would be. So they would, the journals are part of the problem too. The journals would encourage researchers to not be too nuanced about the results and say, well, we have, if someone would come up and say, well, we've done the experiment 10 times and 7 out of 10 didn't work, the journal would say, leave it out. Leave these 7 out, because it's, you know, it's, people do not want to read this. It's not, you know, it's not, and this is actually true. This type of exchange went on. So there was in general, and this all comes out from the Leveld report, and well, you read it, of a sort of what Leveld would call a sloppy research culture, where it's, you know, people are not bothered too much about being very, what is the word in the code of conduct, not to be very scrupulous about the way they work. Interestingly, and you might suspect this, when the Leveld report came out, What do you think that the response of the social psychologist was?
How would you respond if you were a social psychologist?
Deny it, say it is only at university or something like that?
It is.
It's only in this subset of I wouldn't do it, but maybe some people who are not really.
Okay, that's one strategy, yes. But the main response was totally different and even more openly defensive or offensive, if you might call. Some professors, and I talked to Pim Leveld, who was the chair of the committee, and he said, well, he really got hate mail. In a language, he said, that you would not expect from a professor in social psychology, from Germany, from the United States, from Holland. And they would say, first of all, you are investigating the fraud of one experimenter, and you are not expected to investigate a whole field, a whole subdiscipline. Second, you're biased. You're from a different field of psychology. Pim Leveld was an experimental psychologist in the field of language, so psycholinguistics. But the field of that type of experimental psychology is totally different, because you have what you would say real measurements. You also measure bodily stuff, and not just, you know, the responses by in social psychology experiments. You would go for verbal reactions of people, or choosing what people do, but not really actually measuring the difference between perception and what people say they are doing. So it's a different field of experiment. It's more strict. It's more natural science type experimental psychology. So what they said was, you are actually discrediting a rivaling field of psychology. You hate us, and you use the Stapel case to do something what you shouldn't be doing, judging a whole field. But actually, that's too easy, because Diederik Stapel published, together with 70 other social psychologists, he published in the top journals in his field, which let's say 10 journals. So there is, it's not just one isolated unit in one university where this was happening, and the codes of conduct, the actual codes of conduct in this subfield of psychology, was indeed, as Leveld described it, and debatable at that. So it's understandable that they were, the social psychologists were angry. But the bottom line of their defense was, this is the way that we work, and don't interfere. So they would say, we have our own methodology, and outsiders cannot judge that. Okay, so what we have here, I started, and in the middle I said it again, that one of the main problems of doing social science can be that if you are self-indulgent, if you concentrate only on your own subfield and you publish for your colleagues, you rival with your colleagues, but in the rivaling you are together in one style of working, and you are defending yourself from criticism from elsewhere, like Pim Leveld, but also criticism from all these people that wrote in the newspapers after the fraud of Diederik Stapel came out, and they all said, well, we should actually stop the whole research of social psychology, because it's useless. it doesn't amount to anything. These people do silly experiments. No, it's not of no use to anybody. So they would have to. There have been a few social psychologists that dare to respond in the media. Say, this is a time where so many social problems are at stake, and especially we experimental social psychologists can contribute to the solutions. And then they would come up with some seemingly good ideas, but actually they were not really related to real experiments. One last thing. In this same month that the Stapel affair came to the open, there was a very solid book published. Actually, it was two volumes which was edited in part by a Dutch social psychologist, Paul de Lange. He's every once in a while he has a letter in the newspapers, which is called Handbook of Theories of Social Psychology. Two volumes. And in it are 50 theories of social psychology. 50. And they do not really connect to one another. So here you have a field with 50 rivaling theories, and common ground is very hard to find. If you would put it in a positive manner, you would say this is a field in development. Because, I don't know what you think, but in order for a field to be solid, mature, whatever word you might want to, you might at least expect that there is one central theory from which other theories emanate or connect. There's one connecting grand theory. And in social psychology, there's not. So this either means that they have a very complicated subject matter, which is true, I think. But on the other hand, it's apparently possible that you have all over the globe many research groups who do their own thing and publish in their own journals. And that the urge to work together and make up a larger theory, well, this handbook tries to do that at least, but it's not common.
How does this compare to other social sciences? Is it a special case?
I think it's to have 50 rivaling theories or... someone in Dutch invented the word theorette, a theoret, like a small, fancy little theory, which is not to be taken seriously. And I think social psychology has more little theories than other fields of social sciences, which is maybe because they do experiments. Because for doing experiments, you need to have a small-scale theory. At least that's a tradition in social psychology. Now, there's one thing I have to address. One last thing, and which is the role of publication pressure in this whole. This was one of the defense lines of Diederik Stapel, that... he had let himself be pressured into, you know, publishing much, and in order to publish much, you need to have experiments that worked. And if the experiments didn't work, you would, you know, be tempted to Photoshop or falsify or whatever. As I see it, there's a whole, and this is not just social psychology, and maybe it's not just the social sciences. It's a tradition, I think, that is all over the place, except maybe for the humanities so far. That is that people have to be productive within the universities. They have to publish at least one paper a year. And that has to be in international journals, because otherwise it won't be in the Science Citation Index. And you're discouraged from writing books or doing something that, you know, is connecting various strands and doing theoretical work on a larger scale than an article, a journal paper would allow you to do.
I would say that one is a conservative estimate.
Sorry? One is a conservative, yeah, that's true. No, I say at least one. Yeah. But the interesting thing is, well, if you look at the regulations in my department, for instance, I think it's one. They say at least one. But the point is that is a formal criterion. So every once in a while you have your yearly talk with your superior and say, well, okay, you have one publication, why not two or three? But okay, well, I cannot do anything against you because you did your job and you had your publication. The problem is that, and this is maybe something you can discuss later on, that what is actually the goal of doing scientific research? Is it producing papers all over the place? No, it's not. It's trying to understand stuff, how it works, what are the mechanisms, how did it come about. And if, as soon as you have a good explanation for something, you can decide to make a paper out of it, or decide not to make a paper out of it and say, okay, but I have a few other questions relating to the first one, and I want to check that first before I start writing about it, because I do not fully understand it. I have an understanding of how this works, but how about this, and how about this? I want to write a book about it, because I want to connect a couple of themes and try to build up a larger framework for understanding this type of things. That is what you... If you were really free to choose what you do, you would do that. Or you would make another choice, like Trudy Liu. She talked to you last week. She has written two books in Dutch on very important phenomena that had to do with depression and ADHD, I think. And writing about the history of the concepts of the involvement of pharmaceutical industry and of the way that scientists themselves are part of a game of redefining things. So she chose to write a book about it. She chose to write it in Dutch, and to not only write it in Dutch, but in a way that people who have finished their high school could understand it. Well, that's a choice that is not very popular. So. And she got into problems with that with her university, but maybe she told you that. But
she opened the lecture by saying that she only did it because she was old already, and she feel that she could do it.
Well, for young people, it's well, the thing is that young people who want to do what Trudy did, more often than not, choose to leave the university. There's plenty of young people. I see that in my own faculty. And in my own field, that people are young people, they do their PhD and then they say, okay, well, I'm not gonna stay here because if I want to be a researcher, half the time what I have to do is to try and get money to do my further research. This is not the way I want to work. I want to do something that is directly useful. So, but apart from that, one of the problems of which added to the Stapel fraud case was that it had become normal that your success and your prestige is measured by the amount of publications you have. And that's a real problem, because even if you agree with the fact that science proceeds by publishing for an international audience, it does not follow that you have, on a machine-like way, you have to produce a paper every year. Why would you do that? That is just because to show that you're not lazy. And your supervisor, your professor, needs it because his or her research group needs a certain amount of publications. So you're all under pressure to do that. Now you can maybe understand why in some cases, and it goes from top to bottom, if a professor, like Diederik Stapel, but there are other examples, says, okay, let's not be too scrupulous about the way we work. We need the publications. And if there's something wrong with the publications, the chances that it is found out are not too big. And even if they are, maybe, no problem. We made an honest mistake. We made an honest mistake. There was no fraud involved. So, and here's the problem, that you will not easily be found out, because there's about 1.5 million publications, I think, in the last year over the whole field of sciences, which is a tremendous amount. And the chances that people actually read publications, what is the percentage of people that read the publications on average? If you issue a publication, how many publications aren't read at all? Maybe by the reviewers.
If you're lucky.
Now, well, the reviewers, someone will have read it. But maybe sometimes not even your co-author. So there is a problem, which is that you're stimulated to produce, stimulated to write, but not stimulated to read. You're stimulated to quote and cite, to make references, but not actually critically read and do something with what you have read. And I think, well, there's a problem on the whole that which exceeds the social sciences, which is also addressed by science of transition. I think that's a real problem. And I think, of course, you can discuss about ways of amending this, and one of them would be that people would be encouraged every once in a while to work together and write a book which, you know, summarizes results in a specific field, and let's do away with the ideal of competition. Of course, what is competition in science? Competition in science really is who has the best ideas, but not who gets the most money. And the latter, competition is always thought of as, who's the first to publish? Who's the first to, and well, because then you have the chances of more money. But it's not actually, much to do with the substance of what it, of science. But that's a moral kind of thing, or a science political opinion. But it is a fact that in the cases of fraud, this type of thinking, as long as I have plenty of publications, I'm okay, because I will be able to show that I do something worthwhile and be able to get money for future research. So it's a little, like a little factory. Research groups are little factories. And the main point here is that there is a strange element in the way, and maybe I'm quite old-fashioned here, but I think science is about being curious to find out how things are, how things work, how, from what causes things result. So science should be curiosity-driven and not publication-driven in order to work properly. And these are not just, I would say, industrial accidents. It's something that is in the system that you get people say, okay, photoshopping, maybe, you know, cutting some corners every once in a while. And it's when you read books like these, you really see that there's a bit of a system in it. It's not just an accident. Okay, I think I'll stop here. I covered my ground more than, maybe. So I hope it's worthwhile. I have a few minutes if there's not still a question or a comment.
Well, I have a question.
Yes.
Well, first of all, thank you for this very nice lecture. But in the end, you sort of mentioned that the different types of integrity. So there's, of course, the systematic integrity, the way the system works, and of course there's the integrity of the person,
yes.
For instance, for Dieter Gestapel. Who do you think is most vulnerable to the system? Would you say that it's, that we should change the system and then it could never happen again? Or would you just say that people like Dieter Gestapel are just really trying to sort of use the system in its own benefits,
yep.
For his own benefit?
Let me put it this way. The main danger to science is not the Dieter Gestapels, because they're pathological figures, and you have them everywhere, in every sort of system. And they're helped by the system to get away with it.
Yeah.
But the real problem is, and I agree with the Leveld committee in this, is the spread of what he calls sloppy science. That it's people are so eager to produce their papers that they allow themselves and their colleagues to cut corners and Photoshop their results. And I think that's a far bigger problem than the occasional fraud. And that is not just because of the sloppiness of the sign, but also because it takes away energy from doing something else, which is taking your time to reflect on what am I actually investigating? Is this the real issue that we should be concentrating on, or are we just being led along by the system? So you need some time to resist the urge to produce all the time and to say, okay, let's what's going on? What is going on in social psychology? Actually, this case has produced some beneficial results. One of them is a very good article written by Naomi Elemers, who now is the Universiteitshoogleraar at this university. She's a social psychologist working in Leiden originally. And she wrote a very good article, which is called Connecting the Dots. And the dots are the pieces of confetti that are spread out by the 1.5 million of papers that are produced, and say, okay, we should, in experimental social psychology, we should connect the various disintegrated results into a more coherent framework, and we should work together with adjacent fields like sociology, but also history and economics. So she has used this case to make, well, she made the stand before, but now she said it again. So, well, this is what happens when you have no real connections with other social psychologists and adjacent fields in the social sciences. Okay. Well, I hope this was food for thought. And don't hesitate to mail me second line, you think of something and say, okay, how's this, how's that? Because this is something I'll be working on for the next few years, I think. I really am committed to this case of not science not just being integer, but also being meaningful. So that's the most important point, actually. Do something meaningful when you're a scientist. Okay?
On that note, thank you.
Thanks for sticking with us till the end. The next speaker will be Hans Radder, former professor of science and technology at the VU or Free University in Amsterdam. Until then, happy perceptions!